What's up, guys? I just want to give you a little information on how to come support us. Come find us at rockfin.com/truthzilla. Ooh. You can find all of our content there. And you can, if you go there, you're not using YouTube. Yeah. And even your clicks, we just get crypto for it. If you want to get an account, you can support us. And all of our friends are there. All of our Charlie Robinsons.
All the premium episodes.
And Ricky Vrandas. And, you know, Tinfoil Hat. Everyone's there. So, in addition to that, you can also come check out our Patreon.
Patreon.com/Truthzilla.
Sounds good. Or get a sick shirt at truthzilla.org/shirts.
Woo!
Yes.
All right.
Is it org?
.org, yes.
.org.
Yep.
Maybe that's why I can't get into the thing.
Yeah, truthzilla.org/shirts.
Okay.
All right, everybody, enjoy the show.
Welcome to Truthzilla.
Woo.
All right, I got Scott here and Ed. Sorry, Megan couldn't make it again. She's still kind of recovering, but yeah. We love you. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah.
Today is a very special day. We have Zoe here, who we actually met at a Freedom Cells meeting.
Yeah.
Another reason to be a part of Freedom Cells. You get to meet amazing people.
Yeah.
But she is a medical coder at a hospital. But Zoe, thank you for coming on. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm honored to be here.
It's pretty cool. Really is. So we've been talking quite a bit, you know, offline and in our little Telegram channels. You've just been dropping some serious knowledge. And I keep saying, oh, we got to get you on the show. We got to get you on the show. And so I'm super glad that we finally were able to make it happen. So where do you want to start? I know that you've got a lot to cover and I've got some questions, too, for sure. But let's get into it. Like what?
Well, I would just say, yeah. What is the job of a medical coder?
OK, there you go.
That's a good place to start because most people, when I say that, they look at me cross-eyed because they have no idea what it is. So a medical coder, and I actually have some history that I'll read to you on this, and that is where the Gates connection comes in, dun, 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 not to give away the plot. But so a medical coder is someone that reads medical records all day long, and they take what's written in your medical record, like if it says you have hypertension, for example, there's a code for that.
Sure.
If you have COVID-19, there's a code for that.
Oh, yes.
That code then gets put on a bill that goes to your insurance company. The whole purpose of the United States is the only country that does this, but the whole purpose of the coding for billing part has to do with the insurance company doesn't want to actually have to look into your medical records. So I spend the time looking at it and I put codes on there that they can just then run through an algorithm. And if you understand what an algorithm is, that's AI. And the program that I use also uses algorithms. So I actually work in an AI system all day.
Mm. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're still with us.
Yeah.
So I guess, so you're looking at all these codes. And now for me, I've looking at what's happened in hospitals across the country since COVID-19 has hit, you know, my big question is it seems like there's been this blindfold pulled over so much of the medical world, right? Like, and the trust is broken on my end, you know, not to say there was a ton to begin with, but, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's hard for me to believe, because I do believe that most people that go into this field are doing it for good reasons and want to help people. But there was this point when COVID-19 hit where it seems like, I mean, there's a myriad of different examples we could look at from, you know, the treatments we found early on that they wouldn't look into it, such as the hydroxychloroquine or the budesonide, or what's the other one I always forget?
Ivermectin, maybe?
Ivermectin, you know, yeah. There's these treatments that, why are we not using those anymore? You know, why are we waiting for this vaccine? You know, and, you know, more recently, why is there no flu? You know, there's all these things that, you know, as just a layman out here looking at it going, well, there's obviously something going on, right? I mean, and we have our theories. We've gone into depth on many shows about it. But you know, as someone in the system watching how these codes are laid out, and, you know, we've been on with Dr. Scott Jensen, who said, you know, that basically, you know, it used to be the doctors were supposed to, they were trained to, when someone dies, to identify the cause of death. And there could be the top cause, there could be a secondary, there could be third, but in the case of COVID-19, no matter where it is, COVID-19 is on top, is my understanding of is how he put it, you know, whether you died from a car wreck or a heart attack or a stroke, if COVID-19 is on there, that's what the death is listed as. And you know, yeah. And I mean, we know the CDC has told us that 6% of these deaths are only 6% are had COVID only. So I guess there's a whole bunch there, but why is the medical community going along with this? Why is not everybody a whistleblower in this system?
That's a good question that I've been asking myself and I have yet to answer. Yeah, I sort of went down the rabbit hole very early on because from what I saw, it was blatant fraud from the get-go. I mean, even when they started saying Wuhan virus before it even came to the US, like I just thought this is going to be another SARS, it's going to be another flu scare, people are going to go nuts for a while, and then it'll blow over like all the other ones, and we'll go back to life as normal, and they're just going to make it seem like it's just going to be another flu. And that's exactly what it turned out to be, just another flu with no more mortality rate than it was before, no worse than it was before. But the country lost their mind and it hasn't ended.
No,
certainly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't see how a lot of these medical professionals can't see through it. My only suspicion is that they are in person with these physicians, with these other regulatory institutions, with the leadership of the hospital, who is told that they will not get paid unless they follow this narrative and they follow the directions. And I think when you're in person and you're being told that and you're being told to be afraid, they know that making you afraid removes your ability to think critically. And they know that these are intelligent people who usually can get past their fear. They can get past their fight or flight response, and they can think critically under pressure. That's why some of these people go into work in an ICU or an ER. But when you've got this propaganda coming at you from every single angle and you don't really have time to think past just what you're being told and what you've been trained to do, it kind of leaves you at a loss. And I think that's kind of where I have an advantage because I'm not in person all day. I'm not having to deal with these people face to face all day. I'm not getting told all of this in person by someone that I trust and have a relationship with all day. So it's easier for me to think outside the box, I guess.
Sure, sure. So I guess, you know, I would naturally ask, so as a medical coder, how did the codes shift when this thing happened? Like it was like, what was the major difference you saw?
So I was kind of going to go into a little bit of the history there. Cause sure, there's some dates, there's some organizations that I kind of wanted to link together that people are probably not aware of. I wasn't even aware of all of these before this year, when I seriously went down the rabbit hole to try and figure out what the is going on. So the AMA, which is the American Medical Association, was established in 1847. So it goes back quite a while. There was the first edition of the International Classification of Diseases, or then known as the International List of Causes of Death. So that is what we now know as the ICD-10 system. And it has procedures and diagnosis codes that go along with it. So that institute was established in 1893, and it was from the International Statistical Institute. So it's always been a statistical reporting system that we've been using with the codes. Here's where it gets interesting. In 1948, World Health Organization was founded and was entrusted with the International List of Causes of Death system. And in 1967, the World Health Organization stipulated that member states, the US being one of them, had to use the current revision of the ICD system for international recording and reporting. Ever since that time, every person who sees a doctor in any way, whether you see a chiropractor or you see a naturopath or you go to a hospital or you go to a clinic, if you just go through a drive-through and get a vaccine, there's going to be some sort of medical record and there's going to be some sort of code, a diagnosis code, a procedure code, maybe even just a drug code for the charge for the drug. So all of those things have codes that
the World Health Organization
has tracked and been reporting on for all this time.
So you said earlier that the codes were kind of, I thought they were linked to a US thing. Is that wrong? Am I wrong on that? That's international? The codes are used internationally? Okay.
Yes. The codes are used internationally. They're only used for insurance purposes in the United States.
Certainly.
Okay.
So they're only linked to payment. Sure. That's the key, because when they changed the codes, they made extra payment for COVID in the US. So I don't know if that was true for other state or other countries like the UK or Australia, because they don't use this tied to their insurance or their benefit.
Well, we can make some conjectures just from looking at a place like Belarus that was offered almost a billion dollars to lock down their society and mask their people.
And they pushed back and said, nope. Yeah. Nope. And then we've seen them get like whatever the leader, I can't remember specifically what it was, get embroiled in all kinds of like international controversy and like all sorts of like hit pieces, like through the media and stuff. We're not going along with the New World Order. Right. So there you go.
Right.
Yeah. So no, interesting.
Do not want. Yeah. Last piece of history that I recorded, and there's more, but this is as far as I got, was in 1972, the Rockefeller Foundation joins the World Health Organization on a task force for vaccines and fertility regulation.
Oh my God.
Okay.
So
fertility regulation.
Fertility regulation.
And what came out of that?
Weird motives.
That's where we got Norplant, which is the birth control that goes in your arm.
Okay.
And that's also where we get the anti-HCG vaccines. And when they were tested on third world country, i.e. India at that time. So with the World Health Organization and the Rockefeller Foundation partnering together, that brought us that.
Wonderful. Beautiful partnership, you know,
and so,
you know, we can take that a step further, right? Now we're looking at, you know, who's in charge of the show. You kind of alluded to it earlier. It's, you know, Bill Gates has kind of taken the reign of, you know, what the Rockefellers put in place. Right. And it seems like, and he's just perpetuating that same narrative, you know, the whole population control, like it's just basically eugenics.
It's all
right?
Eugenics.
It's all eugenics. Really eugenics. It really is. I mean, I think that's what we're seeing here. Absolutely.
Well, so my personal experience when the Wuhan virus came through,
I had worked racist.
Oh God. You say it here. We're fine. We know. Our audience knows. They're awake.
Yeah. I was working in healthcare probably since 2004 on and off, so quite a while. And my mom works in a lab. She managed a lab at a university hospital, not going to say which one. So she knows her stuff. And I grew up, you know, at the dinner table, we would talk about the testing that was being done, how the hospitals would work. I sort of, you know, knew about germ theory before I even went to school. Obviously, I got all my vaccines because we were a healthcare family, so we get all our vaccines. But early on when the Wuhan virus came through, I had been in healthcare when the previous, you know, new flus had come through. I didn't know all of the knowledge that I have now, but working in the hospital at that time, we would do something called a rapid flu test. And it was a similar test to the COVID-19 one, but it had some differences. And so right away, I thought, why are we doing the same test differently than how we did it before for a flu? It shouldn't be that different. Mm-hmm. So right away, my alarm bells were going off.
So how is it
Wuhan
different?
Wuhan turns into Corona, and suddenly we don't have a test for this, and we're trying to test with the rapid flu test. And the way the rapid flu test worked, it never said PCR on it, ever. Not when I worked in the lab, not when I looked at the methodology for how the test was done. It never said PCR next to it. We had other PCR tests that said PCR and were very specific saying PCR. And we know that those aren't ones that we can do in-house. We have, even though we were a large university hospital, level one trauma center, we could not do that test at our facility. So we had to go through this process to send it to another hospital that could. Or we would have to get, you know, special machinery to be able to do a rapid flu or a PCR test. Yeah. So the rapid flu, it was just a swab that you could get in your mouth. You could get in the very end of your nose. It didn't have to be, you know, all the way up in your brain or anything like that. And it was a very simple test. And it was one that we didn't need to do all the time. It wasn't like you showed up to the hospital and you have the sniffles and you automatically get the test just to screen. It is not a screening test. It is meant for if you have severe symptoms that can't be explained any other way, and you really want to know what virus you're dealing with so that you can come up with the right drugs and the right treatment for it, then they would do a rapid flu test. Most of the time, they would just treat the patient for the flu, send them home, never do a test. We never needed a test to prove that you were sick. If you have symptoms, obviously you're sick, right? So when I saw this test that was not a screen, somehow being used as a screen, and now the methodology for collecting the sample even changed, I thought, okay, this isn't right. So I started looking into it. And I found a peer-reviewed study from the Mayo Clinic, which I'll provide you the link for afterwards.
Great.
And it specifically said in there that PCR testing should not be used for confirmation of anything. Yeah. That really a viral culture is the best thing that you could use to isolate and identify a virus. Not PCR, not reverse transcriptase PCR, no methodology. And like six different kinds of tests, methodology that they could use. And they systematically reviewed every single one. And they came up with viral culture is best, but if you do a viral culture, you could aerosolize the virus. And that would be dangerous, especially with something like a brand new flu that'll kill everybody. So it's so dangerous. We just can't do it, is what it said in the paper. But when I worked at a different, so I've worked at different hospitals. When I worked at a different hospital, also a level one trauma center university hospital that had most of the send out capability in-house at that hospital, there was a virology lab and I would have to go in there and get samples sometimes. And, you know, doctors would call me up and ask me, what's the result? Is the test done yet? Because it would take like a week. It would sit there in a machine. It would rock back and forth. It would sound, you know, crazy weird. It had to be like in a super cooled environment. So like there were these special refrigerators where these tests would be. And every once in a while I'd have to go in and check them. So I know that viral cultures are something that we did on a routine basis. So it struck me as strange that the Mayo Clinic, who should by anyone's standards be on the up and up of that particular practice, especially if they're studying virology. So, again, alarm bells are going off that this just isn't making sense. And then the rest of the cycle threshold stuff came out. People started talking about, you know, the false positive tests. And later I did a little bit more deep dive because I started noticing in the hospital, and this is probably 6 months into the pandemic. So multiple tests have come through. The Mayo Clinic came up with their COVID-19 PCR test, and my hospital adopted their test and their methodology. And I thought, if the Mayo Clinic says this is the wrong one to use, why did they then develop it and give it to other hospitals? If we know it doesn't work, that doesn't make sense.
Let's be clear too. Kerry Mullis, the inventor of the PCR test, said you should not use it as a test as well. So going right along with that, but.
Right. So then I started to check the test results on every single patient that came in COVID positive, because I thought there is no way that all these patients really are COVID positive. A lot of times it would say asymptomatic and the patient would be in for like a gallbladder removal. And I have to put COVID number one as the primary diagnosis, even though we didn't treat COVID patient didn't have any symptoms, but oh my God, they might have COVID. So coding guidelines say we have to put that up front, and that's what the insurance will pay. So the hospital gets extra money, even though the patient's really just there to get their gallbladder out.
And just to be clear, that is a new regulation. You've never had to do that in the past before this. Yes. Perfect.
Correct. So in March, they came up with coding guideline changes. Every year we do an update. Mm-hmm. In October, we'll do an update. That's when our diagnosis codes start. And then on the year, January 1st, our procedures will change. So there's actually two times a year where different code sets will change. And we all know when that's going to happen because the computer people have to come in and shut down our system and then upload the whole new coding system for us to use in our program. So it's always a big pain when that happens. So it happened in March, and they created new guidelines, and I printed some of that out also. This is really easier if I do it in person, but yeah, so we came out with interim guidelines because we didn't have a code for COVID-19. So all we had was like a generic virus diagnosis code, and the hospitals weren't getting paid, you know, very well for that. It's what we call a junk code because it's not specific and it doesn't give you any valuable information about what's going on with the patient, but we had no other option. The guidelines, you know, said you have to have some sort of a code to show what virus it is if you know it's a viral disease. So we would code, you know, pneumonia, just a generic pneumonia, like unspecified code. And then we would code just some sort of flu virus, just a generic
LI, right?
Code, like as a placeholder. Yeah. So that struck me as weird because that in my 11 years of coding, that had never happened before. I asked other coders that had been there longer if that had ever happened in the history that they're familiar with. And they said, no, that's totally and I hate this word, but unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So again, that kind of struck me as weird. And the guidelines, they specifically state, so again, this was maybe 6 months into everything. So this is after we came up with a specific code for COVID-19 and the new guidelines were in effect. So the previous guidelines said you can't code you can code a flu-like illness as flu unspecified if the patient comes in with a flu and you're not real sure what it is. And that sort of made sense because we know there's different strains of the flu, but,
you know, flu looks
the same in the symptoms. So it doesn't really matter if it's flu A, B, C, D, F, you still get treated the same way. So it really didn't matter.
And flu, just to be clear for our listeners too, like flu, I think it was about 2014, they started doing it. It was the flu deaths that they record every year are not just the flu. They're not all people who've had a flu test. And as I think what you're getting at here, that they've, and other flu-like illnesses or respiratory illnesses are all lumped into one category. So when we hear, you know, that there was 80,000 flu deaths last year, it doesn't mean that these people all had a test and got flu. A lot of them had pneumonia and other respiratory illnesses. In fact, I think the percentage of people who actually have been tested for the flu is somewhere around the 15%, if I remember correctly. But
I think they classify them as like...
Sounds correct. No. It was pretty low that we would actually test for the flu before COVID-19 came around.
Interesting. Have you seen, and I know I want to get into this eventually. I don't know. I don't want to interrupt your momentum here, but definitely about how like the whole chart, I'm sure you've seen it where it's like on the CDC website where it shows like the color coded flu outbreak. You know what I'm talking about? Where it's like, so at the peak season, like all the states are like purple, which is like maximum amount of flu outbreaks. And then if you go back to like the 2019, 2020 flu season, and then you go to that same week this year and it's all green, 100%, no cases of flu whatsoever. And then you click on like on our state, you click on it and you go in and it shows like Oregon Health Authority. It shows like the whole state each week, like 2000 flu tests. And then out of that, there's like one or two actual positive flu cases. Like that just blows my mind. To me, that seems like a smoking gun. I mean, about the nonsense and the shenanigans that are being played.
Reclassification?
Here. Yeah, the reclassification.
Oh, it for sure is.
Yeah. So.
I had a case where they were very sick. They just got sicker while they were in the hospital. Really nothing that they tried to do to save this patient worked out. So the strange part was, this patient had some symptoms, but the primary problem was not COVID. There were like multiple organ failures and massive infections and, you know, way more serious comorbidities than COVID, but all they cared about was COVID. However, our guidelines at the time, our hospital guidelines, not the official guidelines, hospital policy was we had to go into the chart, and it didn't matter if the doctor is saying this person has COVID-19. Normally for a flu-like illness, that's all we would need. And for them to have symptoms, obviously. If they just said flu and no symptoms, well, we'd have to query the doctor and be like, where'd you get this from? Because it seems like you're pulling it out of midair. So this particular patient, I sent a question to my auditor. I said, I'm questioning the COVID status on this patient. They were here for quite a while and they died, but no COVID test was done during that time. Now keep this in mind, anytime. And this was even true before COVID. So this is kind of standard of practice in medical care. If you just walk into a clinic, hospital, whatever, your doctor is going to do their own exam and they're going to come up with their own answer. Most of the time, they're not going to take the exam from another physician. They're going to want to do their own. And with COVID-19 in particular, we were not accepting outside tests. Even if someone said 5 minutes before they walked in the door and they had it in their hand that said, I'm COVID-19 positive, treat me, we wouldn't do it unless we did our own tests to confirm that they really had that. Because at that time, we weren't really trusting the test results from outside our hospital. We thought we had the right answer and no one else did. So this was just really, really weird. I had coded plenty of other COVID patients, and this one was totally opposite from every other one. My response was, the official ICD-10 coding guidelines state that a positive test is not required as long as the provider is documenting that the patient is COVID positive or a COVID patient. In other words, the coding depends on the doctor's opinion. If the doctor believes it is COVID, then we code it as COVID. So, to me, I interpreted this telling me to commit fraud, but I went to look at the guidelines to make sure. And this is when it really popped out at me, because honestly, when the new guidelines came out, I knew there was a new code for COVID-19. I knew I'd be using it all the time and I didn't really care beyond that.
Sure.
But so the guidelines are interesting. It says, for COVID-19, code only confirmed cases, code only a confirmed diagnosis of 2019, COVID-19, blah, blah, blah. They say it like nine different ways. For a confirmed diagnosis, assign code U071, COVID-19. This is an exception to the hospital inpatient guidelines, section 2H. In this context, confirmation does not require documentation of a positive test result. The provider's documentation that the individual has COVID-19 is sufficient. So when it says it goes against its own guidelines to do this, right there, I knew they created this loophole intentionally, and they are planning on exploiting this loophole. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. So, and you know, this is the same thing we've heard Dr. Scott Jensen talk a lot about this, that he, when he got that piece of paper from the CDC telling him how to code these, I mean, he was blown away and he just blew the whistle on the whole thing. This comes back to the question, why are there not more Scott Jensens and Zoes? Why are there not more?
Yes. Where are you people? Come out.
Come out now.
And it seems like people have gotten on the defense to defend against the whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. Like the whole system has, it's gone to protect itself. Like, and it just seems so obvious that there's major fraud going on right now. Like, and I mean, you can, we've gone into all the different pieces, the PCR, obviously the PCR, you get into the cycles, and what cycle threshold were you guys using at your hospital? Do you know?
They never said, and I went and I looked for it. I looked for it for weeks, for multiple, every way I could possibly think of. Sure. I even went to the send-out labs and their methodology. Cause I knew we were using an Abbott test.
Sure.
And I remember reading in, Abbott is the kit test. And I remember reading in Plague of Corruption by Dr. Mikovits. Yeah. She talked about how Abbott was at the table of one of these very fraudulent meetings that she happened to be a part of. And so my alarm bells went off when I realized, oh my God, this is an Abbott kit test that they're going to mail out to the whole country. And they're already known for causing fraud. Yeah. So this isn't going to end well. And then, yeah, we had two different PCR tests we were running. There was RT-PCR and regular PCR. It did not say what the cycle threshold was. Sure. And then this was really interesting. So when the flu just completely disappeared, mm-hmm. I was going and I was looking at all the testing over and over because I kept thinking there's got to be a positive flu in here that they're just not telling us about, because statistically it's impossible for it to just disappear like that. And what I saw then was we had changed the test and we had obfuscated the way to find the test. So as we're going through this, the hospital keeps changing where we put the test results. So even from one patient to the next, the way that I have to find that test result changed. So they made my job real hard trying to find this. Luckily, I'm a really good researcher. So when I need to do my homework, I'm like a dog with a bone. I won't let it go.
Wow.
So I went and I did some digging and I found where our test results were, and every single patient without exception to this day that we are seeing that has a COVID-19 screen, we'll call it, it is now a combo test. So at least the way they're listing it is a combo test. So it's tests for flu A, flu B, RSV, which is a different respiratory
virus. Rhinovirus, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And COVID-19. Wow. I only ever saw 100% negative, so negative for all four viral strains, or positive for just the one COVID-19. Never positive for anything else. I have not seen a positive flu test in all of 2020 or all of 2021. Nope. And when I started looking at that, I thought, okay, again, there's fraud. And mm-hmm. to me, that wasn't explainable by the cycle threshold alone. So I went to look at how is this test done? What is the methodology? Because when I worked in the lab, there were some tests that I was allowed to do. If they were kit tests, we could set them up. I did, I was just a lab assistant. So I just got the tests ready to like go onto the machines. And then the medical technologists were the ones, or the MLTs. Mostly it's MLTs now. They're like an intermediary to the bachelor's degree kind, but they were the ones that would actually do the testing. And every single day, on at least three times a day, so every shift change, and we worked 8-hour shifts, so three times a day, we would do a control on every single test that we would, on every machine. So you have to calibrate the machine, make sure the machine is still giving the correct results. And like for chemistry tests, we would have reagents that we would send through and make sure that your chemistry that says your sodium level really is giving you the accurate sodium level. So we would have a control that we know what the sodium level should be on this control. And if it came out correct, then we know that the machine is measuring accurately. Well, the PCR test is not a test that you put on a big machine like that. It's a kit test. So you get essentially, it works sort of like a conveyor belt with, you know, Legos on it. So the conveyor belt is your substrate that comes from the lab. There's no control for you to test. That's just kind of the framework for your Legos to go on, like your piece of cardboard that you put it on or whatever. And then the substrate is also comes from the lab, Abbott or whoever you get this from. So you need both of those and then your sample in order to grow your virus at whatever cycle threshold. So you have to have the substrate and the, I forget what, and the medium essentially. Mm-hmm. And then you add in your DNA and your medium will, it's basically the building blocks, like the A, B, G of your DNA, and it will assemble those together and make it look like the, for a better, lack of better way to put it, make it look like the DNA sample that you put in and amplify it. Because obviously you can't make copies without something to create copies with. So when I looked at that, I realized, oh, well, if you program the medium to be positive for COVID-19, because a PCR test only looks for one thing. It is programmed to look for one particular thing. So if I have flu A, that's going to be one PCR test. If I have flu B, that's going to be a different PCR test. If I have hepatitis, which is a viral disease, that's going to be a different PCR test, and on and on and on. So when I realized these are specific to the virus, why then is this even a combo test? You can't just throw a bunch of stuff in there and expect to get an accurate answer. And clearly we're not. So what if this is pre-programmed to say whatever it is? And that would be the perfect way to control it. Mm-hmm. I don't have any evidence that that is actually happening. But right around the time that I figured that out, I saw an interview with Dolores Cahill. And she mentioned that she was going to test the test and sequence the test to see what comes out of that testing. So putting two and two together, I think she's suspicious of the exact same thing as me. And she has the means to be able to prove or disprove that theory. I do not.
It's kind of like the, what, the president of Tanzania, right? With his little fruit and the whatever. The goat, I heard he died today. He died.
He did?
Yeah. It took him out today. God. Yep. I just saw it on my little news feed. Yeah. Crazy. I don't know. Well, he said he died of a heart attack, right?
There's the Erica Badu that had the one nostril positive, the other nostril negative.
Yep.
What was it? Elon Musk that had like what, multiple in one day. I mean, at minimum, everyone should question this test very minimum. Right. But you did say a couple things. I have a question for you. So did you previously, did we use PCR for different influenza strains?
Yes, that's what I discovered this year that I did not know. When we were doing rapid flu tests all those years, they were PCR tests. They just didn't tell us they were PCR tests. So they were putting the wool over our eyes even way back when.
And I guess this would be a greater question. So do you know about when that changed? Did it change when they started? I mean, I think it was 2014, if my memory is correct, when they started lumping in all of the flu-like illnesses, the respiratory illnesses, into those flu death numbers. And it seems like there's almost like a long game going on here, right? Like they're like this was all played in succession to when this day came. We have this shitty test that we can make the results we want. And we've already lumped all these things together into one thing. So now we're going to incentivize the medical community to get the positives to say this thing. And we'll just put them all as positive for coronavirus. And they'll be incentivized to do it because we're going to give them money for it. So it just seems like it all just the puzzle pieces just kind of fit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
Oh, yeah. It goes even further than that, too. There's something called HCAHPS, which is a survey that you will get as a patient after you've been seen, usually as an inpatient, but sometimes if you had something like a surgery. And it's kind of like the survey that you get after you've had your car in for a service, only sometimes, and they're not allowed to anymore, but sometimes when you took your car in, they would tell you, please take the survey and please fill it out well, because I won't get a raise. I won't get a promotion if you don't fill it out 100% right. Like you can't even write one single four. Everything has to be fives, all good, or, you know, my life is over sort of thing. That's really what the HCAHPS are. When I was a supervisor at a hospital, I was told by my superiors that I needed to instruct my employees, whether they were seen as patients or whether they were just filling out their employee survey, their satisfaction survey, or whatever, that we needed to fill out these HCAHPS and they needed to be 100% that we were doing really well. Then I learned that is tied to money from Medicare. Huh. And I feel like that was a, I feel like that was part of the long game, because what it did was it incentivized hospitals to make sure that the perception of patients is that we really are taking care of them and that we're curing them. And that went along right around the time of the decade of vaccines.
Ooh,
God. And we know that Gates was in trouble for the exact same, well, he was in trouble for antitrust laws. Mm-hmm. And how did he come back from that? Why are people no longer throwing pies in his face?
Philanthropy.
PR campaign. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Philanthropy. And yeah. So I felt like that was the hospital's PR campaign to get patients to, you know, think that they're really being taken care of. And the entire hospital is geared toward, especially if you're a nurse, you get this like shoved down your throat from morning till night. Even when you're not at work, they will try and find a way to get in your head and tell you how you need to be so that the patients perceive you a certain way.
Wow.
So it really is a PR campaign, and it's tied to money. It is tied to your job. I was not able to get a raise or give raises to my staff if we didn't have good HCAHPS scores. And my mom, when she was a manager, same thing. They would sit in so many meetings and talk about HCAHPS scores. So I felt like that, again, if you're not allowed to give an honest opinion and you're not really allowed to, you know, do a deep dive and figure out what went wrong and how do we fix it, then you're not really accomplishing what you say you're accomplishing. It's all a bunch of fluff for appearance sake.
Yeah, certainly.
Wow. Holy smokes.
Yeah, I think they've geared the whole society towards that way though, right? It's like it's the communitarianism aspect. It's
sounds like a little MK Ultra.
Social justice warriors. Yeah. It's like it's kind of all comes into play. It's the cancel culture, right? It's everything kind of fits right in, you know.
So we've made it this far, right? And if the YouTubes and the whatever's out there in the world at the iTunes aren't pissed off enough, I was hoping to maybe throw this in there too, and talking about some of the adverse events that you're seeing and how that's being reported. You want to get into that a little bit? Really burn this thing to the ground?
We are extremely behind in my caseload, so I'm not really seeing cases in real time. I never do. Most of the time I'm seeing stuff that happened a week ago, but we're so far behind now, I'm seeing stuff that happened like a month ago. So now I'm seeing the second vaccines for healthcare workers, the first vaccines for teachers, and the first and second vaccines now for the elderly. I'm not seeing anything from jails. However, if a patient does need some sort of care, then police will bring them into the hospital and the hospital will do whatever they need to do. And then we send them back to jail. So
for the people who aren't let out of jail, let's be clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not real sure how all that works, but I'm assuming if they send you back to jail, it's because you didn't, you didn't do something right. And
Yeah,
still
exactly.
Gonna be locked up. I mean, I don't know how else to put it since they're not following their own laws, but
yeah.
So overall, I've coded about 11 adverse events from COVID-19 specifically. There's actually one case that I threw in there that struck me as incredibly strange because I have never seen this happen before. And it was someone about my age. And you can't see my gray hair. I'm no spring chicken, but I'm not, you know, over 65 either. And this person said they were feeling well, had their daughter at their home that day, and ended up, daughter left within an hour. This patient called 911, an ambulance arrived. This patient was demented. This patient was perfectly clear mentally an hour prior. That's not dementia. Yeah. That's what we would call encephalopathy, where your brain is not functioning properly, or altered mental status. Some people get into that state through, you know, going in and doing hallucinogens. Like, it's that kind of, you're not with it. You don't know who you are. You don't know where you are, that kind of thing.
Well, that is a known vaccine side effect, though. Like, not just specifically to this vaccine, but you can get that from other vaccines too. It's kind of like when your brain swells and it's from inflammation. So
yeah,
that's called encephalitis, but it causes the exact same thing. Yeah. Yes.
Sure. Encephalopathy is essentially, it's just when your brain just doesn't come out of that state, right?
Yeah. It's anything that's opathy, it basically means there's something wrong and they don't know what it is. So it's kind of a junk word to describe symptoms.
Sure.
I used to work for a veterinary cardiologist. And when he said cardiomyopathy, it just means the heart's not working right and we don't know why. And wow. It's just a fancy word. So yeah, just a little medical terminology for you. But yeah, so this patient was demented and had fecal and urine all over her, couldn't walk, was on the ground. So I don't know how someone who's perfectly fine an hour prior ends up in that dire state in such a short period of time. And this patient goes to the hospital, and I forget the exact thing that happened. No major past history. So we keep hearing in the mainstream narrative that, you know, if you're obese or you have all these other things, then you're going to die of COVID because you're immunocompromised. Well, immunocompromised, as they're using it, is a flat out lie. And every doctor who understands what immunocompromised means would agree with that. I even had a conversation about me possibly being immunocompromised because I got sick all the time and had all these allergies and everything. And a chronic pain condition. I had had surgeries before. I'm like, what? So can I be immunocompromised to maybe get FMLA? And she said, no, you're not immunocompromised. You need to be much worse to get immunocompromised. Mm. And she had like an ethical issue with certifying me as being immunocompromised. And though I got sick like once a month. So it takes a lot to be immunocompromised. And what they're saying is not right. Anyway, so this patient was not immunocompromised. She had a skin issue that they couldn't figure out. So right away, that on the inserts of vaccines, it says if you have eczema or skin rashes or skin allergies, that you should not get a vaccine. So I did not find anywhere in this record that this patient had the vaccine, but she was the right age to be a medical professional who could have been eligible for the vaccine. And she was unresponsive and unable to give any history. So there's no way for me to know if that really was the case. But it was really, really strange because, oh, she wasn't breathing either. So she had to be intubated and put on a vent. She had liver failure. She had kidney failure. She had other organs fail. She developed a temperature. And she died.
Wow.
I've never seen that happen before.
Well, the ventilators they're basically a death sentence, right? Like that, we've kind of know that from looking at what happened in New York. I just read Erin Marie, I forget her last name. Undercover epicenter nurse. And it's just like, what was going on there? I mean, we should... You know, at first when this thing hit, everybody wants, we need to get ventilators, ventilators, ventilators. But the ventilators they're using, almost everybody that went on one died. Like literally in New York, I think everybody did.
60-90% they said.
Yeah, I think it's 90. At least 90.
Yeah.
Right. Like in some of these hospitals, it was. Yeah. Yeah. It's so she ends up going on there. And are you saying, so there's, you've seen 11 deaths so far?
No.
That you've coded just 11 adverse reactions.
And deaths, but there have not all of them are dying. So here's kind of a big key is I code inpatient only. I don't do ER. I don't do outpatient. Sure. So like, even if you, like a lot of times, even before COVID, if you had chest pain, you could be in the hospital for 3 days while they try and figure out, well, did you have a heart attack? What kind of heart problem do you have? Because they'll want to put you on a monitor and kind of watch your heart rhythms for a while before they send you home. And that might be like an observation stay. So you can be in the hospital for a few days and not be an inpatient. Typically, if you're there more than 2 days, the rule from Medicare is they have to make you an inpatient, but there's other criteria you have to meet. So what I see is the worst of the worst. I think your Bell's palsy cases and your minor cases are going to be your ER cases. And even before COVID-19, there were literally hundreds of cases of children who had vaccine reactions that were being denied by the medical professionals. They would literally get a vaccine within 1 or 2 days and come in with whole body rashes. And the doctor would just say, they're allergic to something. I don't know what it is. Here's some allergy meds.
Holy crap.
So that's pretty well established before all of this. But what I am seeing is I am seeing massive blood disorders, like clotting or uncontrollable bleeding to the point that you bleed out and you die. That's one thing that Dr. Mikovits had mentioned, was this thing called ITP, or idiopathic thrombocytopenia. The idio part, I like to say it means your doctor's an idiot. but what it really means is they don't know the cause of it. And I'm noticing that a lot of these vaccine reactions, like fibromyalgia is one of them, Bell's palsy is another one. This one I'm going to have trouble saying, Guillain-Barré.
Guillain-Barré.
That one. Also, the medical professionals just say, we don't know what it is. I think MS is one of them. And I know someone that has that. And I'm highly concerned about this person getting the COVID-19 vaccine. There's been 2 patients that got COVID either from the vaccine or at the same time. Now, I struggle with saying this because I know correlation is not causation. But although I realize it is entirely possible for someone to possibly be developing a flu before they get the vaccine in the same day or the next morning, then they show symptoms. It might not be from the vaccine. It could have been something that was developing beforehand. I realize that is a possibility. However, it's definitely suspicious. Sure. When we're told that if you get the vaccine, of course, mainstream media says this, the vaccine company's own documentation says it will not prevent you from getting the virus. It will not prevent you from spreading the virus. All that they tested it to do was reduce symptoms. And those symptoms were mild because they didn't test anyone that had to go to the hospital for their symptoms. So they didn't test for severe symptomology at all, period. So why get a vaccine? It's not going to end masking. It's not going to end distancing. It's not going to end lockdowns, none of it. But they tell us that because they need us to take this vaccine willingly because they know how dangerous it is. And it's easier for them to deny liability if we do it to ourselves voluntarily. And that's why they're not going to force vaccinate us. At least that's my opinion. That's what I believe.
Well, I've always had the opinion too, though, that when we see some major reactions from this, they're, you know, if everybody's had it, then it's just a new strain of COVID. Mm-hmm. We can just blame it all on a new strain, right? They're already setting up all the different strains. So everybody get this vaccine. Of course, vaccines don't cause injury. So you just got a new strain, right?
Yep.
Right. Well, one patient was in a nursing home, had fallen, and that's what landed him in the nursing home, had fallen and broken a hip. And, you know, obviously he had hip pain because that's the biggest bone in your body and it's broken and you just had to have surgery and have a nail put in there. I mean, obviously it's going to hurt. And that's why I had to go to skilled nursing because can't walk. Yeah. You know, the same way you used to, you got to have a walker and assistance and all this stuff. So he was there, got shot while he was there and came into the hospital with COVID-19 symptoms after the vax. Huh, that can't happen. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's what the medical professionals all said. Like, no, that's not happening. They said this patient is septic. So he had a systemic whole body infection. Whole body is inflamed or swollen because of this infection, and they can't find the infection source. Like, so the hip hurts, but it's not abnormally hurting. Like, we expect there to be pain, but it's not an abnormal amount of pain. There's nothing coming from the wound. There's no drainage. It doesn't look red. It doesn't look inflamed. He didn't fall on it. He didn't do anything to make it worse. but he came to the hospital after the vax with COVID-19 symptoms and this massive infection. So what do they do? So normally, this is kind of background information just so you can know how fraudulent I felt like this was. Normally, if there really is an infection, what they would do is they would do a series of imaging to see if there's some sort of pocket in there of fluid that they could drain. If they can't find something like that, they might even just go in and bring the patient in for what we call a debridement, which is where they kind of like scrape off some of the dead or dying tissue and hopefully get back to healthy tissue, and then they dress it. And hopefully if it's infected, they've removed the infection that way. They didn't do any of that, but they said, well, this patient has sepsis from the infection from the hip injury. Because it can't be from the vaccine. No, can't have anything not. To do with the vaccine. Even though he just got the shot 3 days before he showed up, can't be the vaccine. Then there was a different person. Same thing. Had COVID directly after getting the shot. Like that day. Same day as COVID. Perfectly fine before that. No symptoms before that. Developed symptoms the same day as getting the shot. And then comes into the hospital and just has COVID-19. Doesn't die, just has COVID-19. All your same COVID-19 symptoms, has the COVID pneumonia that we're always hearing about. And the doctors are baffled. What is going on here? Patient had the vaccine, they're not supposed to get COVID after they had the vaccine. The vaccine works. So they can't have COVID unless it's a different strain. So what do they do? They send tissue and samples off for genome sequencing because they thought, well, it has to be a different strain then that this vaccine doesn't cover.
Of course, yeah. We're inching towards that narrative for sure. I think I even heard somewhere someone said, oh, there's a new strain in Oregon. I think I heard somewhere on like NoaGen or something. I could be totally wrong.
I mean, there's so many things to talk about, but I mean, one of the things too is, I mean, depending on which vaccine it was it the Pfizer or was it the Moderna, you know, I mean, these each have two shots. So, and I mean, they didn't get a lot of the antibodies after the first shot in the early trial. So that's why they added the second booster shot. So, and there is always the threat. And one of the things I've been so worried about with this whole thing was that the idea of the pathogenic priming or the immune enhancement, you know? So, and as I think after the first shot, a lot of them, they would get a lot of the binding antibodies. So there was always the threat, you know, if they came in contact with the virus at that point, that this virus would do what it did in all the ferrets with the trials of the 17 years of the first SARS and coronavirus vaccine trials they were doing, is all these ferrets died because these binding antibodies would when they were introduced to the virus latched on and wreaked havoc on them, like way worse than it would have been if they would have never got the vaccines, right? So I think that there's a big threat. There's kind of that time in between them that. You know, and I, you know, I don't know for sure. I listen to a lot and do my own research, but I think there's a big threat that we just don't know. But the biggest part of it though is we have these doctors, like you're saying, that will do anything to defend the vaccine. The vaccine didn't do it, but they'll also, you know, sick or not, they will blame everything on COVID. Mm-hmm. So we have this, everything is so skewed that like, we lose on both ends. Yeah. We lose on both ends. And what happens in between is the great reset. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what we get for this.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yep.
I laugh because it's better than the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're putting in the fight, you know, yeah, I mean, certainly. Like, you know, I just keep hearing over and over that we're just doing what we need to be doing. You know, we're speaking the truth. We're trying, you know, each one teach one. If we can just reach one person, and maybe one person takes what they heard today, goes and looks it up or shares it with another person, you know, that's how this is going to happen. I kind of feel like just the zeitgeist and the atmosphere, I feel like there's awakening happening. I really, really do. You know, and even though it just is demoralizing on a constant basis in town here, just going around seeing just these loons everywhere. Like it seems overwhelming. Like it's the vast majority still, yeah. But like even in just like my little circle, it's like I see little lights coming on and little bubbles coming to the surface. You know, I start to see just a little bit, a little tinge. Some of the people that like I work with too, they're just diehard, like all about this shit, dude, that like probably were burning down shit up in Portland all summer, you know, those types of people, right? You know, but like, you know, now they're starting to like, they're starting to even be like, you know, like I'll see them walking around the office with no mask. And I'm like, okay, yeah, they'll never admit it, you know, because they're just hypocrites to the death. But like they're starting, like it's starting to peel away, like something's happening. I don't know. So we're doing what we need to be doing. And I think especially with like freedom cells too, I think right now the best thing we can be doing is just building community and building friendships and building trust and just building all this stuff. And do you want to touch on anything that you've got going on as far as that goes? I know you've been kind of making some things happen in that realm too.
Yeah, I've been really active in Freedom Cells. I've been going to pretty much any meeting that I can, trying to network and figure out kind of what the bigger picture is going to look like in the long game. Because I think everyone in the short run, you know, we want to get our food systems together and just be self-reliant and independent from the system. Yep. We're all aware of that. And I think we're all individually working on that and kind of using each other for tips on how to get there. But we're not quite like creating that community where we really feel supported. And I'm really working on getting the organization together so that we can get people together in real life and start to build those relationships so we actually do feel supportive. So we have someone we can just call and we know they'll be there if we need them.
Yeah.
Or if something happens, like we know where we're going to go, what we're going to do, how we're going to deal with this. Because those kind of things will make us feel more secure and more independent. And I think that's the ground that we need to stand on for this. Because I don't want to go into too much detail, but I've gone up against this kind of evil before. Yeah. And there will be casualties. Yeah. You have to accept that. Yeah. You have to be willing to give up your job and lots, if not everything that you love. It's going to get dark. And we need every single one of us to support each other through this because it's going to take everything we've got.
Wow.
It's so true. Yep. So true.
Yeah.
So I would just inquire. So looking back on the timeline of COVID-19 in the hospital setting, what was the, now I know, you know, they're telling us across the board that, you know, you guys, I mean, 2 weeks to flatten the curve so the hospital's not overwhelmed. What was it like in the hospital setting?
They were a ghost town. There was no patients there. Our census went way, way down. One thing that people don't realize is that an ICU is designed to be at 75% or higher capacity. They want it to be higher because they make more money when it's higher. They lose money when they don't have bodies in the beds, essentially, because it is one of the most, that in the OR and possibly the cath lab are the most expensive units in the hospital to run because you have to have a one nurse to one patient ratio. And then you got to figure that for every patient, you've got like a team of specialists that are on call that are physicians. And then one that's your hospitalist physician that's coordinating all of these specialists to come in and see your patient, as well as everything else that patient needs. So if they're on a vent or whatever, that obviously takes, you know, extra effort. And that's what the ICU is set up for, is life support. So right away, when we're not allowed to send patients to the ICU and we're sending patients out of the ICU that need to be there, but we're making room for all these patients to come in, I thought, well, that's not good patient care. And we're sending patients home that should not be sent home. And even Medicare will penalize us financially if the patient comes back in because we didn't cure their whatever, and they come back within 72 hours because they're still sick. Whatever we do after that point is free. We don't get the money for that.
Wow.
So we don't want that to happen. We'll keep you there for a couple extra days to make sure that you're fine. So when you go home, you stay there. That's what they want.
Wow.
So that totally went against everything that we've been told. So very, very strange. And we had no work. Most of our bread and butter is, you know, surgeries, like your things that you would not consider an elective surgery, like getting a hip replacement or a knee replacement or having your gallbladder out. I mean, unless you show up and you're septic and you have an infection and it bursts or whatever, that's considered an emergency. But even if you're inpatient and you've been throwing up for 2 weeks because of your gallbladder, that's not an emergency. They'll schedule that for some later time. So these elective surgeries, you know, there were patients at home dying of cancer waiting for their surgeries. Yeah. So I felt like right away, this is just terrible patient care. And then the visitation got shut down. So now hospitals are scary places. Like, I don't know if you watch Robot Chicken, but the crazy, the crazy scientists, you know, with the hair going everywhere, that experiments on people. Like, I feel like this is like something straight out of a horror movie. You walk into a hospital, they're experimenting on you, and now you're alone. Now you don't get your support system. Now you don't get your loved ones next to you. Now you have to be in the scariest place in the world by yourself. I thought, wow, this is engineering everyone to think of hospitals as being the worst place ever. And people were staying away. They were staying away as much as they could. Our hospitals were completely empty. Everyone was staying home as long as possible, which means they were getting worse and worse and worse. And walking into the ER and dying on the floor before they even got admitted and having heart attacks and passing out from respiratory failure because they waited too long to come to the hospital. So they were so scared to come to the hospital, they were staying away. And then when they did come in, we couldn't save them. It was awful. And then it stayed so slow that I got furloughed, almost lost my job. They forced us to take vacation for a little while. And then we got a form that said, I voluntarily agree to not get paid for 1 day a week until you guys say so. And I told my boss, I'm like, look, they just started unemployment and COVID relief. I can make more money on that than I could working for you guys. So why don't I just quit? Because I don't want to do this long term anyway. And if someone else can keep their job. And they told me, you have to do this or 9 people will get fired.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, it says right here, voluntary. What part of I have to do this or other people will get fired is voluntary? That's called coercion.
Totally. 100%.
They denied it and I had to sign. I was forced to sign a voluntary furlough. But we did get a lockdown in March. It didn't come when everyone else's did, but it did come. And when it did, that is when our numbers began to go up. That's when the hospital started actually tracking the numbers, not just posting the CDC stuff on their website. They're actually tracking our hospital cases. And then when the masking started, that's when our numbers started to climb. When the masking was required everywhere after lockdowns, that's when our numbers went up. And then it was June when we had a second lockdown. So we did actually open up and masks were not required for a little while. And then in June, we did like another lockdown because they thought our numbers were going to go up. They weren't that high. They went up after the second lockdown again. So I thought, what is going on here? None of this makes sense. And then in there, you know, they updated the guidelines. So again, I'm like, this doesn't make sense. And then I debunked the PCR thing, which they continue to push. Yeah. And I thought, this just doesn't make sense. They opened the visitation a little bit and then they shut it down again around, you know, the election. Because of all of that going on, and our hospitals did get pretty full, and our numbers have stayed pretty high with COVID because, you know, masking and lockdowns have stayed high. So if that's where the numbers are coming from, then I would say that tends to fit the anti-narrative, I guess, just be something to disprove.
A case could also be made, though, that when you did these lockdowns and all these people weren't in for their elective surgeries and then their cancer treatments and whatnot, and they weren't taking care of things that they should have been, that then when they came in and everything was labeled COVID, that they were in a much worse place, right? Like, so the hospitals could have been fuller after these lockdowns because people weren't taking care of themselves, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I know people that, and to this day, it continues. People are putting off things that they need to get done because of COVID. And some people were told they couldn't. Like, I
Sure.
I have a family member who needed a surgery during that time, and they were told, no, you can't have it. It's elective. And this was a timed thing. Like, it needed to be done by the time this patient made it to a particular age.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, pandemic, so can't get it done. Sorry. And then they opened it up, but they said, okay, so your child has to be in the hospital without a parent, or at least just one parent. I'm like, seriously?
That's not okay.
How unethical is that?
Yeah.
I noticed they went against their own rules too. So in their visitation rules, they said that if you were a demented patient, i.e. you don't know what your name is, where you are, you need help with everything from eating to walking around. Nurses, even in the ICU where it's one patient to one nurse, they don't have the capacity to do that. Like, I sat in the ICU with a friend of mine who could not feed himself, who could not drink on his own. And that nurse told me while I was there, I'm so glad you were here because I could not do this. I can't do this for every patient. Every patient needs to have someone here. Now, that was before COVID-19. That patient would not be able to have someone there. Even demented patients were not allowed visitors. Patients were dying during this time with their family on the phone. And this would actually be written out in the nurse notes or in the doctor's notes. I talked to the family. The family called me. They're screaming at me. They're crying. They're saying they want to see their family member that's dying, and someone needs to be there with their family member because they need help. They need assistance, and it's part of your policy. And those nurses and those doctors refused to let the family come in and see the patient, even though it was part of their policy. So they didn't even go with that policy. And at the very beginning, I did notice that we had a lot of patients that were on a vent for a really long time, like a month, which is really unusual. Like, usually if they put you on a vent, they don't keep you on it for very long. They start talking about, you know, pulling the plug pretty quick. And there are patients that, you know, they do think will recover. So being on a vent isn't necessarily a death sentence, but there are patients that just are pretty compromised and kind of older to begin with, that have a chance of not coming off the vent. So they kind of deal with it case by case. So the vent in and of itself isn't considered a death sentence, but the way they were doing it was really weird. And they started doing something I've never seen them do before, which is called proning. So prone is when you're your face down, which is really weird. And these patients, they would have so much like secretions that they thought that, you know, putting them face down would help drain everything out. It just killed them faster. And the ones that didn't die, we sent them to nursing homes.
Wow.
And that's where people got it. And then when the mainstream media, who I don't follow, but I heard it from other people, that they were reporting that, you know, the nursing homes were the ones spreading the virus. So then they stopped. And then the governor, I guess, told nursing homes that they had to take patients if they were COVID positive. And that has flip-flopped throughout this entire time.
Yeah.
They stopped sending them. And then I think right before the election, when they started saying, well, if everyone goes and celebrates Thanksgiving with your family, you're going to spread it. What did they do right before then for a couple months? They started sending COVID positive patients to nursing homes again.
What the hell? Now that
Biden is in office, what are they doing now? Nursing homes will not accept you if you have a COVID-19 positive test. So where do you go if you can't take care of yourself? You can't go home. You can't self-isolate. They'll send you to a quarantine camp.
Yep. The shielding approach. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what else to say. That's it right there. So yeah. Zoe, do you have any other final words, final thoughts, anything like that?
I have one more bomb I'd like to drop.
Oh, let's do it.
Woo-hoo. This is just something, it's not like knowledge that I have, but this is just something that I really wanted to get out to anyone who's in the medical profession, who is face-to-face seeing patients. If you are the one who is responsible for keeping family, friends, loved ones away from your dying patient, it is your ethical duty to allow those people in to see that patient. I don't care if you make them wear a mask or whatever. Of course, I don't support masking, but if that's what's going to get them in so that they can actually get that closure. That closure that is pretty much one of the things that we work toward our entire life.
Yes.
When it is your moment to pass, we all think about that. We all know that that moment will come. Some of us have children thinking that we will, those children will be there to take care of us and they will be there to say goodbye to us at the end. We have spouses, we have friends, we have siblings that we want to be at our side at the end. And if you are the one denying them that closure, if you are the one denying them that moment, you are part of the problem.
Yes.
And you will be held personally accountable for that.
Yes.
At least one person that I love died alone in a nursing home because of people like you. And it's disgusting.
Yes.
That is all.
Yes. So wow. Agree. So agree. So agree. And do you think that's part of the agenda? Like, do you think there's kind of that?
Yeah.
I think that's part of the dehumanizing part. Yes.
Certainly.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Wow, Zoe. Well, thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you so much, Zoe. This is good information. Glad to hear from an insider that's seeing it right across your desk every day. So, thanks so much.
Let's stay connected and help our freedom cells kind of combine as we grow here.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, hope so.
Sweet.
Good things to come.
Good things to come. That's it.
Definitely. Really, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
And wealth of information. And
yeah,
we would love to follow up if we start seeing some of that, the immune enhancement stuff going on. I would definitely love to hear a report back on that. Because, you know, I know for myself, I have loved ones who have gotten this vaccine as much as I've told them not to and tried to level with them, to look at both sides and to make an informed decision. It's some people, it's just easier to go along with the mainstream, right?
Yeah.
Like, even though they question it, right? Like, it's the black pilled people, right? Like, they're just like, well, it's just easier to go along, which is going to make it harder for all of us.
Yeah.
Honestly.
But, yeah.
Exactly.
But anyways, I would love to hear an update because I know that they're just going to call it the next strain. I predicting that one, I think we all know that's coming. So, but
I think I've already seen evidence of that. So I concur.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Sweet. All right. Well, thank you so much, Zoe.
We'll see you. If I have any info to follow up, I'll definitely let you know.
Cool. Awesome. Cool. Thank you so much.
Have a great night.
Peace. Thanks. You too.
Wow. Zoe was fucking awesome.
That was
intense. So rad to have a medical coder, like someone who's really seen this thing through the entire pandemic, through the hospital view, but seeing how they coded these things, like I feel like there was a lot of really good information there.
A lot of that stuff is the first time I've heard it.
Certainly.
This is like breaking information. So hopefully you guys can go take that information and go out and look it up for yourself. And maybe, and again, if you're a nurse, if you're a doctor, if you're a frontline healthcare worker in any way, shape or form, you need to start, it's on you. You need to start acting up and pushing back on this, you just saw what courage looks like. Are you going to be courageous or are you going to be a little punk?
If you're complicit in this, people are dying.
Yep.
Because of
they're suffering up until their death.
Yes. People are losing their businesses and people are dying away from their loved ones. And this is on you. I mean, what did the Nazis say? Like the best people in the Nazis were just the people who just shut up and didn't do anything about it, right?
Exactly.
The good little neighbors.
They're counting on you not doing anything. And so be courageous.
It's true that you're on the front lines, but it shouldn't be for the wicked agenda. You should be on the front lines of helping to liberate people from the torture, the torment, the death, and this medical misconduct happening.
Or walk away. We need to create our own alternative institutions. That was one of the things I was going to ask too. Like, how do we, like, let's say there's a mass exodus of healthcare professionals. Can we create our own institution?
Yeah.
How does that work? I don't know. But anyway,
Find us on Freedom Cells.
Freedom Cells. Right? Freedomcells.org.
That's how we met Zoe.
Yep.
So,
Freedomcells.org, baby.
That is the solution, baby.
Yep. And,
Well, wow, everybody. Thank you so very much for tuning in with us. That was Zoe. We very much appreciate her being here with us tonight. And until next time, I'm Megan, sitting here with Scott and Ed. We wish all of you intellectual prosperity. Good night.
Pew, 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 pew.